This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Our leaders are willing to sacrifice our lives and our planet in order to keep wealth and power. We can and we must fight back. Hands up!
Anti-war protesters in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and elsewhere call for an end to the NATO proxy war in Ukraine.
In Pajaro, it's a disaster. It's not just the displacement, homelessness, families without anything, but then there's also the flooding of all of these agricultural fields that are the livelihood of those farm workers.
Immigrant farm workers in Pajaro, California, face flooding and systemic racism.
Although President Erdogan has sworn that the elections will take place, it's a known fact that things change at the drop of a hat in Turkey. Anything could suddenly happen at any time.
Opposition parties in Turkey gear up for national elections.
The U.S. is over here saying Ethiopia should be doing something when the U.S. does not allow any American under any circumstances to be put in any forum to be tried for any war crime, no matter how well documented, and is willing to back that up with military force to the point of invading another country.
The U.S. is trying to impose a U.N. war crimes investigation on Ethiopia. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. On March 18th, people from over 200 organizations rallied in Washington, D.C. to protest the U.S. proxy war with Russia in Ukraine and to mark the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War.
Good afternoon, y'all. My name is Afini. I'm a community organizer with Life After Elise, and I'm also an anti-war army veteran. Yeah. We are here to demand peace in Ukraine and an end to the toxic militarism that is destroying people's lives and our planet. America is a country where 1 in 5 children under the age of 5 are insecure, and they are cutting food stamps because we can't afford it. Yet, on March 9th, 2023, the Biden administration proposed a fiscal year 2024 budget that asked Congress to give the military-industrial complex $842 billion. They sell us a false dream that they are protecting women in other countries while the bodily autonomy of women in this country is being stripped from us. They say that one of the reasons why we have to beat Russia, why we have to unseat Vladimir Putin, is to protect trans and queer people in Russia. And there are over 350 bills criminalizing trans youth and trans people across this goddamn country. The U.S. is the world's largest polluter, partly because our military and Biden just approved the Willow Project. The International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin. And fine, I'm not here to defend his actions. But I want to ask, when is the ICC coming to pick up George W. Bush? Yeah. When the hell are they going to come get Dick Cheney? Yeah. Hillary Clinton? Yeah. Hillary Kissinger old ass? Yeah. And they can go ahead and send a warrant down to hell to get Colin Powell too.
Pick up Obama's ass too.
Last time I checked, there are American politicians with over 1 million Iraqis' blood on their hands right now. Yeah. We spend $300 million per day, every day, for 20 years in Afghanistan just to leave them in ruin and starve their people through unjust sanctions. Unsuccessful war after unsuccessful war. Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. We're funding a dirty war in Yemen, dropping bombs in Somalia. We dropped bombs the same day Russia invaded Ukraine. We were bombing Somalia, and the news said nothing about it. We have been escalating tensions with countries like Iran and China for simply trying to while trying to continue our armed stranglehold on the international economy. Let's be clear. NATO pushed the United States and instigated and continue to fan the flames of warfare in Ukraine. Adam Schiff said himself on the House floor that we fight Russia over there so we don't have to fight them over here. From pledging endless support and lethal aid to Ukraine, to blowing up the Nord Stream pipelines, dumping millions of oils and gas into our oceans, we have been backing this war and filling the flames of violence this whole time. War is causing irreparable harm to our planet, and it is a bipartisan effort to back this destruction. No one in any country anywhere, including Somalia, Yemen, Syria, Palestine, or Ukraine, should have their homes blown apart. We condemn the illegal invasion of Ukraine while also condemning NATO aggression. Yes. Yes. We can acknowledge the choice of a people to secede from a country that they were forced to be in, while also acknowledging that we must strive to end all war. Yes. Our leaders are willing to sacrifice our lives and our planet in order to keep wealth and power. We can and we must fight back. Hands up! Hands up! Hands up! Hands up! Thank you.
That was activist Afeni Evans speaking at the anti-war rally in Washington, D.C. Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke was also at the rally and filed this report.
Money for jobs and education! Money for jobs and education! Money for jobs and education!
A liberal radical rally and march of several thousand people, endorsed by some 300 separate organizations, took place at Lafayette Square across from the White House last Saturday, March 18th, demanding peace in Ukraine through negotiations, abolishment of NATO, and an end to U.S. wars and sanctions. The endorsing groups range from the Answer Coalition, Code Pink, and Veterans for Peace, to the Democratic Socialists, Peace and Freedom Party, Black Alliance for Peace and Workers' World, as well as solidarity committees for Eritrea, Palestine, Venezuela, and numerous other oppressed nations and peoples across the planet. Notably absent was any discernible trade union presence, official or informal. This reporter circulated through the crowd, speaking to various attendees about the pressing political issues of today. What follows is some of my conversation with D.C.-based veteran Latino labor and community activist Arturo Griffiths and several of his compadres and comrades.
This war in Ukraine is crazy. That war has opened up a lot of things that are going on in the world. Basically, the fight for resources of the world, the relationship that exists in the world with different groups and so forth, it's been difficult. But I'm here mostly because I do not like the United States to be putting money out like that. Uh-huh. They put a lot of money, billions of dollars, in a fight that is not theirs necessarily. It's not theirs, and it could cause a world war if we keep going with it. So I'm here because I think we have to develop a peace movement, which we don't have in the United States these days. We don't have a good peace movement. We need to build it up. And this march was a good start for it. I really appreciate that. I appreciate whoever organized this thing. So I'm here because of that. And we have to fight for peace or we're going to disappear.
Well, what do you think would be the best solution for Russian workers, Ukrainian workers, workers in Europe, American workers? What would be the best solution in terms of the war, in terms of going forward?
Well, I think that I really have no differences with Russia, to tell you the truth. I have no difference with Russia because Russia, whatever happened in the out there that we could see, Russia didn't start this. Russia did not start this. Putin had to do something to save their country, believe me, to try to save it. So they didn't start.
He was provoked. And they were provoking him and the Russian-speaking Ukrainians.
Yes. We do not like wars, but the Russian people had to save themselves from the surrounding thing of all those missiles around their lives. And the press, NBC, CBS, all they talk about all this thing all the time, and the people don't have a voice. The people just follow what they say. And that's a dangerous kind of thing. I see it's going to take time, but it's going to build up. When we were in the Vietnam War, it took a lot of time, and we built it up to a point where it became a massive movement in the United States. So this is going to begin to happen here too, little by little, little by little.
Arturo, as a Latino and living in America for a long time, you obviously have connections with Latin America all around. How do you think Latin America and Latino workers in general, Mexico, Panama, Cuba, Brazil, how should they react to this?
Let me tell you, what
should they be doing?
Latin America right now, the forces of change that are there now, they basically are not in support of this aggression against Russia. They're not in support of that. What they've seen is that the fascists are organizing in Ukraine. They have a control of basically the country, what they do.
Yeah.
So far, it's a big concern. So basically, Russia, we should not be killing Russia, because Russia, and many Russians died in the past on the Second World War, fighting fascism. So how in the hell our money here is going to be used to save, to put money in Ukraine, which is controlled by fascists? This is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Are we for fascists or what?
Jaime.
Yes, sir.
And?
Gacho.
You're here at the No to War in Ukraine rally. They just took off on their march. What brought you all out here today?
I mean, if we don't talk about peace,
what
are we going to be left with? You know, so that's the main question. The question of resolving that issue between war and peace.
Yeah.
And it's time for all that money is being funneled to this war to be redirected into helping and taking care of the needs of the working class in this country. You know, when it comes to health delivery, when it comes to better paying job, shorter work week, there's so many issues.
How can the working class seize the initiative and actually get those for themselves, rather than rely on the Democratic Party, the liberals of the Democratic Party, who for 3 months before an election promised a bunch of shit and forget the moment afterwards. And yet they do it every election.
Yeah.
So what does the working class have to do to remember these betrayals
and
take the political initiative themselves?
The unions, all of them across the board, there's some that are better than others.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, especially the internationals and the national leadership, it needs to be changed. There are too many of them that are corrupt, too many of them that are collaborating with the bourgeoisie, too many that are so connected with the Democratic Party and the most reactionary elements of the Democratic Party. So it's time to change, you know, the objectives.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And really promote working class standards, working class, and to build a working class movement that can be somewhat similar to what the 30s was, when you had the Wobblies and the organization that was taking place in all of the unions. It was very strong, very representative of the working class, and it had a left orientation, and that left orientation is needed.
For COVID, Race, and Democracy, this is Thomas O'Rourke.
Community activists and trade unionists in San Francisco also rallied against the U.S. proxy war with Russia in Ukraine. Here are some voices from the rally.
Of Palestine. Again, from the International Longshore Warehouse Union 10 Local.
I'm a member of the ILW International Longshore Warehouse Union. He always liked me to say that I am Dr. Huey P. Newton's nephew of the Black Panther Party. We need to stop this war. This war has no place in this world any longer. My big brother reminded me as we were coming here that an honorary longshoreman that came 6 months before his assassination is Dr. Martin Luther King. And he said the largest perpetrator in the world today of war is the United States. And that has never changed. That's today, that's right now. I want to say to my comrade Bert, I want an arrest warrant for Barack Obama. Because Barack Obama put military bases all over Africa. If you look in if you don't know about it, some soldiers were assassinated in the country of Niger not long ago. What were they doing there? We need to know. These bases are everywhere. This is the war machine, and we aren't with it. And my special heart goes out to these children that are being indoctrinated into a modern-day slavery. They're taken from eastern Ukraine right now, becoming slaves, and we've heard of that. It's called the international slave trade. And they're supposed to be thankful that they're going in this war to another family that they don't know. Well, thank you for making me the child of a slave, because that's what I am. I'm your product. So now they call me America's nightmare, and when I'm driving down the street with potholes in Tent City, where people can't afford to buy food, can't afford to buy gas, we can't drive the car that we can afford to buy because the pothole will tear the tires off, I'm supposed to say thank you for killing me when I run a stop sign. Or maybe I didn't even run the stop sign. Maybe I had a little emblem hanging from my rear view mirror. Or maybe I just looked black when I was driving. Power to the people. Let's stop this war. As the sister said, the largest terrorist in the world today is the United States government. I'm not with the Democrats. I'm not with the Republicans. We need a new independent party coming out here. I heard a quote just yesterday saying we need to listen to our young people, our older class, because the young people know things that we don't know. Our older class need to teach the young people because they know things that they won't know. So the younger people, if they'll listen, they'll be more advanced. And the older people, they'll listen, they'll be more advanced in their circle. Together, we can do this. And I want to remind you, lastly, what the fists mean. One is me. Two is you. Three is them. Four is some of us. Five is all of us. Together we can't be beat. Let's make this fist stand up. Power to the people. Stop the war. Stop the war. Let's go.
Good news and welcome. A longtime organizer in the Puerto Rican struggle, Ricardo Ortiz.
The main enemy is at home, down with U.S. imperialism. Some comrades have mentioned about U.S. bases.
That's right.
Some others, we will bow to kick them out of the remaining ones. Done with the U.S. imperialism. I'll be concise and precise due to time, comrades. If you want to know about the United States exploitation in Ukraine, during the 2014 coup that happened in Ukraine, the United States sent a sinister character Natalie Jaresko, a former IMF World Bank official, to be the Minister of Finance in Ukraine to privatize Ukrainian estate property. And that was not the first time that sinister character went down there. During the Clinton administration, that very same sinister character, an Ukrainian American, she was appointed to be the person in transition of the Ukrainian and post-Soviet states to capitalism. She led a task force of AID, World Bank, and State Department officials to privatize the Ukrainian economy by the Clinton administration. And made Ukraine to borrow a few loans from the IMF, which has Ukraine indebted to the core right now. That very sinister character was was appointed as the executive director of the so-called fiscal control board in Puerto Rico to privatize the energy systems and other public properties, and also the retirement funds. And she put that at the hands of vulture funds investors. Thus, the hand of the U.S. imperialists in Ukraine and in the colony. This very sinister character that the Obama administration appointed to be the executive director of the Fiscal Control Board was earning a salary of $600,000 a year. That's outrage. That's imperialism rampage, both in Ukraine and both in the colony of Puerto Rico.
That's right.
So tell me about it. The enemy are not the Russian people. We have to defend the Cuban Revolution with all our might. For the Workers' Party, right here in the United States, let's get rid of capitalism. Let's get rid of imperialism. Don't want a world without...
Those were speakers at the rally against the U.S. proxy war with Russia in Ukraine that was held in San Francisco on March 18th. The rally was part of a National Day of Action on the anniversary of the Iraq War.
'60s classic by Edwin Starr, War. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The massive flooding in California has particularly affected the immigrant farm worker community in Pajaro, where a levee broke and flooded their town. Pajaro Valley Federation of Teachers member Pamela Beth Sexton, who teaches adult education, talked about the plight of this community and systemic racism.
The last weekend, I spent both Saturday and Sunday at the Santa Cruz County Fairgrounds, where thousands of people are evacuated. Their houses are flooded. They told me stories of the water being up to their thighs, up to their waists. Kids, the evacuation order happened at midnight. And so families, and Pajaro is a small unincorporated community in North Monterey County. I live just south of it, and the community is mostly farm workers. We know that in California, like 80% of our farm workers are undocumented. These are my students. These are parents of students throughout our district. And they are folks, just to give you an impression of the community more, predominantly Spanish-speaking, but also lots of Mixteco, Zapoteca speakers, a lot of indigenous Oaxacans who are coming to the community even with limited Spanish. So it's a community that is marginalized by the structures of power and the like systems of support. They're farm workers who already don't have paid medical leave. They already don't have sick leave. I mean, basic, you know, legal rights. And then this happens, their possessions, they only left with what was on their back. And children, you know, in tow, living all together in a warehouse type space. So the need is great right now. I guess I, as a union member, as a human, I also want to say it's really critical to understand this as not just a disaster, not an environment, you know, not, it's part of the systemic racial and economic injustice that has built this country and that we need to radically shift. It's going to happen more with the climate crisis we're in, which is also happening because of the systemic racial and economic injustice in the country. And so I know that my local union has done a great deal to support racial justice, climate justice, economic justice, and now I was with other comrades in the shelters this past weekend, and I just appreciate the solidarity and hope it continues to grow.
And there was some issue about the levees, that they knew that there was a problem, but, you know, there wasn't any kind of urgency to make sure that this area would not be flooded. It's kind of like New Orleans.
That's
poor
right.
Black communities get flooded. And
that's right. And that also has to do with systemic. So it wasn't just a few people who decided, but it's like actually written into policies that, because they're making economic calculations, well, who's going to be most effective, and we need to invest our money in these certain ways. So there's federal rules, there's state rules that work against the communities like Pajaro, and we need to change. Thank you for saying that, because that is a concrete example. When we just talk about, the system needs to change, like how do we change the system? We gotta identify these laws that are leading to this. So in January, just 2 months ago, we came this close, like on the levee, it was that close to breaking, and it was a hair's breadth.
Nothing was done to make sure that...
Nothing was done. So it's not... It's,
so they knew that...
Oh, they knew, for sure. And they were just saying, shoot, we dodged that bullet. And then, you know, Atmospheric River, and they're surprised, and... It's really heartbreaking, and I think only by getting more people together to work more, just earnestly and demand change.
It sounds like an emergency situation for the working class, poor, particularly immigrant workers and communities.
In Pajaro, it's a disaster. It's a disaster that's going to take I don't know how long to recover from. Because it's not just the displacement, homelessness, families, you know, in some cases just without anything. There's that level of economic distress, but then there's also the flooding of all of these agricultural fields that are the livelihood of those farm workers. And the economic composition of our, like, they're what keep our county economy going, our local industry, which needs to, you know, green itself from the agricultural industry to a more sustainable system, but But this is our local economy just shot. So it's a disaster on multiple levels. But this issue of equity and inequality, you know, some people, when disasters happen, depending on what your current income is, you might actually gain some income because of relief funds. But in communities like Pajaro, they're the folks who statistically are going to lose and not be able to gain back. And with that, I'll say that so I live in a beautiful community where there's so many grassroots organizations that have been organizing for decades, and they are working to support the Pajaro families, to create more justice, make sure that these essential workers who during the pandemic kept working in the field, who do backbreaking work, who during the wildfires in Santa Cruz County continued to work in the fields, like who keep our economy happening, keep us all fed and, you know, alive, they doing fundraising to give money back to them. I volunteer with a group called Regeneracion, Pajaro Valley Climate Action, that is working on obviously climate issues and heat stress, extreme heat days, and this flood all disproportionately impact our farm workers. I also volunteer with a group called the Watsonville Campesino Appreciation Caravan, and we do mutual aid, direct aid, showing appreciation to the farm workers, not just through signs of love and messages with information and love, but also through direct reparation, like money over from folks who have more to our farm workers who don't have access to a lot of these government programs.
Yeah. And what do you think about President Biden's opening up Alaska for more drilling?
It's horrible.
You know, you have this climate crisis that's creating a disaster situation, particularly for poor people, working class people.
So it's a slap in the face for communities like Pajaro. It's denial that we're in a climate emergency and that we need to immediately shift our lifestyles, our fuel.
It's like the oil companies control the government. I mean, the oil and fossil fuel codes, that's their drive.
That's right.
That was Pamela Beth Sexton, an adult school teacher for the farm worker community of Pajaro, California, speaking to Pacifica Steve Zelter.
You can feel it. Like summer, I feel like summer, I feel like summer. You can feel it in the streets on a day like this, that heat. I feel like summer. This feels like summer. I feel like summer. 7 billion souls that move around the sun, growing faster, faster, not a chance to slow down.
Gambino feels like summer. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The U.S. is trying to impose a UN war crimes investigation on Ethiopia. Pacifica's Ann Garrison reports.
Last week, Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Ethiopia, where he pressured Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to agree to a UN Human Rights Council investigation of war crimes committed during the Ethiopian Civil War. The war began in November 2020 and ended last December when the Ethiopian army defeated the Tigray People's Liberation Front, a longtime U.S. proxy. The Ethiopian government has established a domestic judicial process for prosecuting war crimes and asked that the UN process be ended. On YouTube outlet Hermela TV, Answer Coalition activist and Breakthrough News host Eugene Puryear explained that the UN investigation has been politically agendized by the U.S.
There already was a UN human rights investigation in Ethiopia that was, by the way, led by a former political prisoner, Michelle Bachelet, who was tortured under the Pinochet regime in Chile, which, by the way, was backed by the United States. So they already had that. But the reason that that's not acceptable is that it didn't say what they wanted them to say, and that was that it was Tigray genocide. And I think that that in and of itself is the whole purpose of this new thing. What they're going to do is try to overturn everything that has already been said on this issue. They're going to try to come in and say Eritrea has committed all these crimes and that they need to be sanctioned. They're going to say that Fano has committed all these crimes in conjunction with Eritrea and that they need to be sanctioned. And that's what it's going to be about. I think there are a lot of people who maybe think that they're going to come in and offer some impartial peace. I'm telling you right now, it's not going to happen. And let's remember here, we're talking about the anniversary of the Iraq War. This is a country in the United States that has passed a law that is known as the Hague Invasion Act, colloquially. It's called, I think, the Protection of Armed Forces Act. What is this act? It gives the president the right to take any action to prevent any U.S. soldier or official in any way, shape, or form from being held accountable in international human rights bodies, including the International Criminal Court. And the reason it's called the Hague Invasion Act is because it actually would give the president the right to invade The Hague in the Netherlands to free any American who is tried for war crimes. And in fact, countries are banned from getting a significant amount of U.S. aid unless they sign an agreement with the United States to prevent U.S. soldiers from ever being tried for war crimes. People may remember when Obama was trying to make the deal in Iraq to keep the U.S. troops there and the U.S. troops left. Why did that deal not happen? Because Iraq refused to agree to the U.S. assertion that in all circumstances, even when the crime is true and permitted to be tried for any sort of war crimes. So the U.S. is over here saying Ethiopia should be doing something when the U.S. does not allow any American under any circumstances to be put in any forum to be tried for any war crime, no matter how well documented, and is willing to back that up with military force to the point of invading another country.
That was Answer Coalition activist and Breakthrough News host Eugene Puryear. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
Bubaray. Turkey now faces national elections in the aftermath of a massive earthquake that has killed over 50,000 people and left over a million without housing. The autocratic Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his party, the AKP, have come under withering attack from political opposition because of the systemic corruption exposed by the government's earthquake response. Pacifica's correspondent Mehmet Bayram reports on the parties joining together to challenge Erdogan.
Elections in Turkey, the collapse of every known principle and rule. One thing that seems certain in all the dust storm that covers the events leading to the elections on May 14th is that the Turkish system of client state, the neocolonial capitalist system, has come to its rope's end. The political, social, and economic crisis sweep the country from one end to the other as the old regime has come to an end and it has nothing to offer to the people and peoples desperately wanting a change. Although President Erdogan has sworn that the elections will take place, It's a known fact that things change at the drop of a hat in Turkey. Anything could suddenly happen at any time. The historical mistrust of the people of anything the authorities say is an old tradition, and it has its own merits. If Erdogan loses the elections, he may face justice and end up in prison, as many in the country hope. For this reason alone, many believe Turkey has entered a very dangerous period where any kind of provocation or false flag operation may take the country into deeper chaos to prevent a fair election. Many others believe that if Erdogan loses, he will immediately fly out to seek refuge in another country where he keeps his billions. For the last couple of years, the ruling Islamist capitalist AKP party and its coalition partner, the Nazi MHP, have been bleeding votes and support. The main reason for this is that the country is finally facing the music any neocolonial country depending on imperialism will need to encounter. For years, Turkey was presented as a model for democracy and growth. However, Turkey's expected demise started to appear a few years back as the loans started to dry up. The current treasury is entirely empty, with unsurmountable debts that need payments, and Turkey is struggling with how to get through the next day. Turkey's reserves are running on empty, minus $44 billion of debt, as reported on March 9th this year in Haberler news site. An economy can survive only so long without producing, by only borrowing and also importing everything it uses. Following the orders of the IMF, the World Bank, the US and the EU, Erdogan kept his promise to open the country to unfettered foreign investments that took what they wanted and left when the resources were exhausted, leaving behind environmental destruction and unemployment. Those who thought Erdogan provided them employment and a civilized life that Europe was jealous of started seeing the reality when their electrical bills jumped up 1,330% in 18 months, as reported by Euronews in December 2022. However, if you were to believe the official statistics department, which publishes redacted, edited, and cooked numbers to favor the government, then in 1 year, the electrical bills increased by 75% and the natural gas increased by 54%. Daily Cumhuriyet reported that while food prices decreased in the world, it rose by 103% as of last December in Turkey. All democratic regimes need a level of support from the people. However, in neocolonial countries, where the dynamics of the system show significant differences from the imperialist centers. Since the regime is built on multitude of layers of exploitation, more often than not, the standard model of democracy cannot be implemented. What defines the way politics work, then, is not what happens in the elections, but rather brute force and corruption. This brute force then becomes a necessity for the ruling classes, since they cannot use democracy to ensure their rule by make-believe theatrics alone. This is why we see so many turmoils, military coups, unrest, strife, and violence by the ruling classes in these situations. Imperialism makes democracy an impossibility in the client states. Turkey has come to a point where a change by democratic means may endanger the established neocolonial system's internal dynamics. However, the people who have to live through unemployment, humiliation, nearly 140% inflation, loss of education, lack of healthcare, or homelessness will be hard to control. Even the trusted base of the current government, the religious and the fundamentalists, have had enough of the AKP government. Usually this would mean an election loss in a functioning democracy. However, the Turkish regime does not have the luxury to toe the democratic line for a change. Turkey's currency has suffered nearly 30% in a year with no end in sight. This is devastating for a country that was forced to abandon its internal production and forced to import even the very basic stuff it used to produce itself previously. How, then, could any government that will replace Erdogan's rule solve the crisis when even the currency is controlled by international finance organizations and foreign countries? Only a revolutionary people's government could take on that task through radical changes. However, the upcoming elections, even if they are held, do not hold such a promise. As Erdogan tries consolidating his weakening power by joining forces with more fascist and fundamentalist parties to form a coalition, the opposition is setting up a few coalitions of very contradictory parties. Erdogan is already in power with the Nazi party of the notorious assassins called the Grey Wolves. The party is infamous for the political assassinations of prominent intellectuals, thinkers, authors, labor activists, and Kurdish and Armenian leaders, as well as drug trafficking, smuggling, money laundering, rapes, and international terrorism, and for executing the dirty deeds of the deep state in close coordination with the government forces. If this wasn't enough, a new addition to the ruling coalition may be the Hudapar Party, an organization that has its roots in the Turkish deep state and was formed to sway the Kurdish population away from progressive socialist ideology to fundamentalist religious tendencies. The organization is known for its very close relationship with the CIA-protected religious clerk Fethullah Gulen, who was a partner in crime with Erdogan but had a fallout after the 2016 coup attempt. This party's preferred method of assassination is through torture, by tying the victim by their feet and throat and having them die in excruciating pain. To join the coalition, Hudapar has demanded that Erdogan repeal all laws protecting women. The main opposition has gathered around the Social Democratic People's Republican Party. This is a very contradictory and fragile coalition, since it involves six completely opposing parties of fascists, religious conservatives, social democrats, and two of Erdogan's previous officers. İyi Parti in the opposition coalition, led by an ex-interior minister woman Akşener, is a split off from the Grey Wolf fascist organization. Party's leader Akşener is responsible for the disappearance by state forces of 17,500 Kurdish minority citizens, whose fates are still unknown. The key to winning the elections is the Kurdish HDP party. Although it is known to be Kurdish-based, it went through a transformation in the last few years with its very progressive politics and declared itself to represent the entire country, both the Kurds and the Turks, as well as other minorities, labor and women. It enjoys a vote of around 11-12%, especially from the Kurdish regions of Turkey. However, both blocs refuse to engage with HDP because of their rampant traditional official state ideology of open racism that prevents any dealing with non-Turks. When the Social Democratic Party showed signs of approaching the HDP, the fascist İyi Parti leader left the coalition. However, in a few days, Akşener understood that she had no chance of surviving alone and she returned in embarrassment. The Republican Party of Social Democrats was scheduled to meet with the progressive HDP as this report was being prepared today, but a last-minute change was reported and the meeting was cancelled. Some socialist parties took their place in the coalition with HDP in a popular front mentality, while others have formed another bloc of a united front, with only the socialist parties participating. These parties look at elections as only a platform for propaganda and agitation and do not necessarily expect much from the result. However, it seems if the push comes to shove, the three blocs against the current government may support the Republican Party just to get Erdogan removed from power. Strategies, tactics, alliances, memberships, loyalties and blocs change by the hour in the chaos. Yet we should not forget that these plans are all based on elections taking place. It is inconceivable that Erdogan and his partners in crimes will simply turn over the government and walk away simply by losing in the popular vote. Erdogan now has Trump's example of how to handle a loss, like on January 6th. He has established a private military force that has bomb-making, assassinations, and social control in its scope of operations. Erdogan's loyal head of intelligence service once bragged that it was easy for him to start a war by sending a few rockets from the Syrian side to Turkey if he was tasked. Turkey is pregnant with violence and all kinds of provocations in the next couple of months. It is evident that all the state forces, street gangs, grey wolf assassins, and secretive dark religious sects being fed by the government and secret services that are ready to start a war are ready for the next move. However, are the people or the forces for democracy ready to do more than vote to save the country from fascism, racism, economic plunder, and the plan to bring Sharia law like they did in Iran? That will determine the results of the elections, not voting alone. This is Mehmet Bayram reporting for COVID Race and Democracy.
Aç yüreğini bir merhabaya, kardeşin duymaz el oldu ya.
And that concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all the Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Akua Holt, Pauline Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer, executive producers, and associate producers Ali Abdulkara, Mehmet Bayram, and Garrison, and Thomas O'Rourke. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.